Our fifth case for today is United States against Michael Murawski. Mr. Levine.
May it please the court, my name is Jeff Levine. And I represent Michael Murawski. Michael Murawski's background didn't indicate crime of any manner. He had a history of hard work. Starting in high school, he worked at Denny's. He was a contractor for years. He installed swimming pools. And then he got involved in real estate. He sold real estate for a while, subsequently started a company called Michael Franks with a partner, using their first names. It was a solid, legitimate company. With investors, they purchased approximately $70 million of commercial real estate. They researched the purchases.
But what's your argument? I don't understand. You're just challenging the sentence, right?
Right. I am challenging the sentence.
Okay. So what's wrong with the sentence?
Mr. Murawski pled guilty to two counts of fraud in February that occurred in February 2011, totaling $2,500. He was sentenced to a range for a loss of $7 to $20 million. My argument, Your Honor, is that Mr. Murawski appears to be sentenced for the decline of the real estate, the value of the real estate that was the result of the real estate market.
So can I just ask a question of clarification? There was a restitution award here as well?
Of $18 million or so?
$18 million, and you're not appealing that?
We're not appealing the restitution.
Okay, so you concede that... I guess, I don't know, maybe even if you were to prevail here,
it seems
a little contradictory to me, too.
Well, we're not conceding it, but the important thing that we're concerned about is his liberty.
Is the sentence, okay.
And that the court...
It sounds like you recognize, though, that from this scheme, from Michael Franks and the things that they did, the defendant did, in fact, inflict somewhere between $7 and $20 million damages. If he's willing to pay back the $18 million,
he
never thinks he will. I don't know.
That's really irrelevant because he's never going to have $18 million to pay back. He would like to. So that wasn't the concern of the appeal. The concern of the appeal is, and the amount of $7 million is what the court came up with. I don't think that's correct.
Record, you know, remembering that it's a preponderance standard and the like, the Ponzi scheme nature of this arrangement really starts pretty soon. And
when do you believe it starts? Because I don't believe that was ever determined when the Ponzi scheme nature of the thing started. There was transfer of money by his partner, but the expert testified that the transfers were legitimate transfers. Further, Michael Murawski wasn't doing the transfers. It was Frank Constant who was doing the transfers.
Well, what do you mean by legitimate transfer? The investors are told, you're investing in this project. And in fact, their money gets shifted around as need be to
at what
whatever
point
project.
You're on it?
At the government's brief, page 5, they say investor funds were transferred in this manner starting in December 2007, continued from 2008 through 2010. They cite to the PSR here and there.
I think what there were intermediary loans between the different entities. There were loans that were documented, and the expert says that these were pursuant to accounting practices. They had accountants and lawyers in the office. They had outside accountants. This was legitimate business work.
Well, even if your characterization of it is a possible characterization, it seems that the district court, looking at this record, finds it more persuasive that there's a different characterization of it, which is that they're moving this money all around and promising, I would say, extraordinary returns on these investments. I was quite startled to see that, you know, people were being told you'll earn from 9% to 14%, and you'll earn amounts of money that seem to me...
Now, at what point were they making
high.
These promises? Because I would agree with you that late in the deal, there were incorrect promises and subsequent false statements that were made later on. But the government's brief doesn't state when this occurred, and that's my contention here on appeal. When was the point?
Why does it matter if by the time the scheme is over, the amount of loss generated falls within the guideline range the district court found?
Because the amounts that were put in, there was no fraudulent instigation when these people invested money in real estate. And lots of people invested money in real estate in that market.
Well, the government says your own experts said that by June 2009
2009 he knew or should have known. But
right.
The money put up until that point, if we take the money that was invested...
Well, suppose we agree that he joined the fraud or became liable in
June of
2009. And then the government says, well, the defendant raised, after that, you know, extracted more than $7 million from investors. So, and that money was lost, right?
All the money was lost because...
Okay, so if he took $7 million from investors as a participant in the fraud and the money vanishes, why isn't that a $7 million loss?
I don't believe... Well, the loss was determined to be $7 to $20 million. I don't believe the amount of the loss was ever determined because...
Look, all it has to be is above 7. It doesn't have to be 20.
To get the 20 points.
So you're going to concede 7 or what?
No, I'm not, because we don't know the specific...
Well, it doesn't matter whether we know the amount if we know it's more than 7, right?
I don't believe it is more than 7.
You agree with that?
I don't...
Well, why does it matter? If the judge is going to give him the enhancement because it's more than 7, why does it matter what the exact amount is?
This is why it matters, Your Honor. It matters because if this was a Ponzi scheme where the person was out seeking to defraud someone from the get-go and taking all the money and using it for himself and hiding it away, squirreling away, planning to run away.
Wait, I don't understand that. If you make someone, if you commit a crime, fraud, and it causes a loss of $7 million, what does it matter whether you pocketed the money or the money vanished into someone else's pocket?
Because there's
you've inflicted the loss. That's the point.
Because there's
that's
an
what you're punished for.
There's an alternative determination of sentencing under the guidelines, and that is what was his intent, what did he seek to take from these individuals.
And his intent is to earn a lot of money. I mean, maybe he thought that this real estate venture, I mean, you say this in your brief, and for all I know it's true, we're both reading his mind. So you're speculating that he's entering this transaction thinking, oh, this is, you know, the goose that lays the golden eggs. You know, I'm just going to have this real estate company. I'm going to make tons of money. And at some point, as time goes on, he's not making anywhere near the amount of money that he thinks he's going to make. And so he starts shuffling money around. He admits a time came.
He did hold on to the real estate investment.
So what? Why does that matter?
Because if he had taken the money, the investments, and handed them over to a receiver at that point, then there would have been no crime. So his intent.
There are lots of alternatives in which there's no crime, but I don't get it.
He didn't take those alternatives.
If we look at what his intent was and what he intended to, what his result of it was, it would have
been... We're just looking at the loss amount.
At the loss amount, but another way to determine
loss... And the loss amount is $7
million. In excess of $7
million. And it could be under the guidelines. It could be less than $1 million, approximately $500,000, if we look at what he tried to do.
It could be less than $7 million, you said?
Absolutely.
That's what
if we look
arguing.
At what he intended to do, what he specifically...
But I don't see the evidence that you put into the record that would take it below the $7 million. I don't see, you know, studies of what the real estate market was doing, even if in theory the bust of the real estate market around that time has something to do with this. I'm not sure if it does, but there's nothing in this record other than just, hey, it was a terrible market to support this. I don't think we can rely on that. But anyway, you'll have a minute for your rebuttal. We'll hear from Mr. Harjani.
Good morning, Your Honor. Sunil Harjani for the United States. May it please the Court. Your Honors, the District Court did not clearly err in finding that the loss in this case exceeded the $7 million threshold. It did this by preponderance of the evidence based on the sentencing record that was presented to
it. I know this wasn't your side, Mr. Harjani, but what evidence was there that would have – what evidence did the District Court reject that would have taken it below the $7 million?
The District Court, in all honesty, Your Honor, did not have anything to reject because, first of all, there was no analysis presented as to a number of what the market, the supposed market decline was and how that affected the $18 million of loss.
Of course, there was a real market decline of which we've all been picking up the pieces for years. And so would you say that if you could show that the value of commercial, this kind of commercial real estate in Chicago between 2006 and 2010 diminished by 25%, I'm pulling a number out of the air, would that affect the guidelines loss, do you think?
Your Honor, the government's position is that it would not affect.
No, because loss includes, what, foreseeable loss,
right? Right, reasonable foreseeable harm and the potential risk of losing the investment. Mm-hmm. And so when you have a Ponzi scheme, you're essentially lying to both new investors and existing investors. You're lulling the existing investors into believing that the opportunity is doing well and doing great.
Right,
you should keep their money
payments
in.
From
and
the
you're
new people.
Making lies to new investors to bring in the additional money. You're putting all of that money at risk, the entire $21 million, at the time you're engaging in a Ponzi scheme.
So the risk that you're imposing on that money is market risk, is your management risk, is whatever other risk.
Right. Whatever risk that may exist, you are, by lying, carrying out the scheme, you're undertaking that risk within the scheme.
You're actually assuming more risk by lying than you would if you were truthful. If you said, you know, I can sell you this property, no promises, you might lose your shirt on it or you might make some money, but that at least, you know, you just lose what you lose.
Right, and the investors at least know what is happening with respect to the investment. Here, they're not telling if you lose, you lose. What the defendant did is, this is doing great, here are your interest payments, and give me more money, all of which were lies in order to keep the scheme going and in order to make the promise payments to the investors. With respect to that loss, and the question was, what was the evidence in the record? Mm-hmm. There are really three principal bases to get over the $7 million.
What if one of the victims had said to him, look, I am desperate to get into real estate. So if you don't, you know, if you don't sell me this interest, I'll just go next door. I know someone else who will. So suppose you just knew that this person would end up with the property that was going to lose tremendous value because of the housing bubble burst. Would that still be loss attributable to the defendant?
If the defendant went into the property with full disclosure by, if the investor went to property with full disclosure by the defendant, that this is a potential loss, with no lies being given to that investor, with no Ponzi payments to lure them along.
Now, see, I'm thinking of whether there needs to be any sort of causal relationship. That is, if you actually knew that your customer was going to buy real estate, wouldn't that be a way of saying, well, he is voluntarily exposing him to market risk, not to the fraud risk, but to the market risk.
Right.
So the part of his loss that was attributable to collapse of the market, he would have experienced anyway.
Right.
Does that ever come up as a possible defense?
It's possible in that scenario if the disclosure was that the market is doing terrible and you're potentially not going to make any money. But here, the opposite happened, because what happened here is the defendant was saying, this investment is doing great. And you're going to make a lot of money and
give
me more money.
Don't pay attention to all those stories you're reading in the Wall Street Journal.
Right. And there was a reason behind it, because the commercial real estate market was dying. So the assumption was that people will be renting property, not buying property. And that's what the defendant offered. He said, we buy property and then we rent it out. And now the rental economy is doing great because nobody can get credit to buy their own property. Everyone's renting. And that's in the victim statements. You'll see many victims talked about that this is why they thought they could make between 8 and 12% or 15% because the rental market is doing great, and that is what the defendant sold. So in this case, it was a consistent false statement when, in fact, the properties were doing horrible and the occupancy rates were horrible for whatever reason.
So I'm confused about how this winds up as a total loss because I certainly have seen plenty of cases where something gets sold for half its value or 30%, but how did this real estate and the money just evaporate?
Right. So the investor's capital only constitute 20% of the purchase price.
And 20% of what?
Of the purchase price of the properties that Michael Franks bought. They were heavily financed by mortgage loans, about 80%.
So there's some other losers out there too, the banks?
Right. So the banks lost money as well because they recouped the property as the first secured lender, and they took a loss as well on their loans in the process. And that's why all the investor money evaporated at the end.
I see.
And as far as the record is concerned, note that the co-defendant's statement and grand jury testimony was in the record, which he stated that him and the defendant, Morawski, shortly after investor funds came in, realized there was no other money available to pay investors and used Ponzi payments to pay them, and also made the improper transfers. There was Mr. Morawski's own interview with the government, where he admitted in 2008 that investor payments went to other properties that were not designated for them. There was financial analysis to show when the transfers started and when the Ponzi payments started, December 2007, January 2008 approximately. Under that, that's what the district court found 2008 as a date. There's a lot of argument by the defendant as to what the appropriate date was and how it was never found. That's wrong. It was 2008 in which the district court found for the improper transfers and the Ponzi schemes. That's when it started. And from 2008 onwards, $16.8 million was raised from then to 2011, well surpassing the $7 million threshold for that. And on the alternative fund, the district court found, based on the record, that 2006 was the date. That is when the defendant made personal false guarantees of.
So that's in addition to this 16.8, the alternative fund?
That is.
Double counting?
That is subsumed.
Subsumed in the 16.8.
Right. And that's $5.9 million, and that started in 2006 because the defendant pled guilty to having made a false personal guarantee. And this was a significant guarantee. If you look at Exhibit B of the sentencing record, it's about six times that the defendant says, this is guaranteed. It's my personal guarantee. You're not going to lose this money. It's guaranteed. So that was a material false statement to the investors. So those were the three bases in which the court said 2006 for the alternative fund, 2008 for the rest. And there's so much overlap because $21 million was raised. It was very easy for the district court to pass the $7 million threshold. And that's exactly what the district court said in that respect.
Did the government push for the 10-year sentence?
Your Honor, the government actually argued for a sentence closer to 20 years.
Excuse me?
The government argued for a sentence closer to 20 years because the offense level we advocated.
It strikes me as extremely inappropriate.
It was actually a guideline a sentence at that point.
I know, but.
Yeah. It was 38 offense level. The district court brought it down to approximately 34, and at that point, that was 151 to 188 months was the final guidelines.
Right.
And the district court imposed a below guideline sentence of 10 years.
Just curious.
I understand, Your Honor. The fraud, however, did affect 267 investors, many of them elderly, many of them retirees who used their IRA funds to invest, and so it was an extremely.
Now the restitution list is a long one.
Yes, exactly.
His 20 years won't get any of these people's money back, will it?
It won't, Your Honor, unfortunately.
In fact, the more he's in prison, the less restitution he'll ever pay.
I think whether he's in prison
20 years, he comes out in his 70s, he's not going to earn anything.
Well, he's going to be 65, the district court thought, if he gets his good time.
With
correct.
A 10, that's for the
yeah,
10
with,
years.
With
the
10, yeah, 20 yeah. would have been.
Yeah, and I would submit whether he did 10 or we did 20, these investors have no chance of looking at any restitution. There's no way this defendant can pay $18 million with a criminal conviction after. So the only thing the investors really had for their own punishment, satisfaction, if you will, was a sentence, which is what they asked for. If there are no other questions, Your Honor, I ask you to affirm the sentence below. Thank you.
Thank you. Anything further, Mr. Levine?
If we look at an alternative sentence under the guidelines, we would look under his intended gain in this case. His intended gain would have been maybe $500,000, which would have dropped the guidelines all the way down. And it's under fraud, it's a subjective belief. Now,
but you only use that if you can't measure loss.
If you can't, if it's difficult to determine, correct. There was a subjective belief on the part of Mr. Murawski that real estate had to go up. It had a core value. It had to go up in value. These were nice units. The units were invested in. They improved the units.
What's the base for your subjective belief argument?
That the fraud is...
Did he testify at the sentencing hearing? Or?
He did not, Your Honor.
Well, how do we know what his subjective beliefs are?
Well, we have it through even the offerings say that market has to get better. The market has to get better. We've seen the market's at the bottom. It's got to get better at this point.
When the district judge arrived at his conclusion based on the PSR, what challenge was made by the defendant to the figure?
We put in evidence of the expert, and the expert said that he knew or should have known at a point in June of 2009. In 2008, they had money in the bank. They had millions of dollars in the bank. They were selling these units to it.
That's before the crash.
No. I'm sorry?
It's before the crash.
Yes, right before the crash. Right before the crash. Right. And they had the units they were purchasing specifically targeted apartment buildings that were outside of small businesses that contributed to the auto industry, which were cooking at the time. So they were specifically researching and targeting these areas where they knew that there would be rental property, and they could not believe that the market would go down to the level that it did, and it would keep going down. And that was my argument with regard to his belief in the market.
All right. So thank you very much, Mr. Levine. You were appointed, were you not? We appreciate your efforts for your client, for the court, and thanks as well to the government. We'll take the case under advisement.